Wednesday, April 11th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, we're going to offer some of our personal thoughts on the fallout from that Sinclair Must Run with the anchors reading that script. We've talked about it on the air a couple of times before in the past, but now that it's out there and it's happened, we're going to have some thoughts, too, to share now that a lot of the nation's talking about it, too. Newsroom employees at the Denver Post, well, they've made a pretty strong plea to its ownership. Sell the paper. You're ruining it. I'll ask Mike and Ernest about that pretty bold move. And the Department of Homeland Security's new plan to create a database to track journalists, bloggers, and online influencers. There's a lot more, hopefully, that we'll get to as well. But let's start with the big doings with Facebook. The social network started notifying users who among them, or should I say who among us, because I can be counted among the 87 million whose data ended up in the hands of Cambridge Analytica. I got one, Mike, you?
I found out mine was not breached.
Yeah, you've got better friends than me. Well, yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg made the trip up Capitol Hill and tried to answer for some of that. His prepared statements had been floating out there earlier, and then the hours upon hours of testimony. Highlights in terms of what he had to say or things about the entire experience that stood out to you?
Well, so first of all, the stakes were really high, as I think we suggested last week, for Zuckerberg, because their stock price has been down, hovering around 11% drop. There's a lot of momentum for regulation. The Cambridge Analytica story really got people angry, and where other stories did not. So he was prepped. I mean, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and lots of folks were sitting, almost like a prep for a presidential debate, right? And he got there, and I'd say I only saw some of the actual testimony live. I read most of the accounts of it. He apologized personally, said their company had not done enough, that they were going to do more. But when pressed on specific issues like, well, do you support more regulation? Yes. Do you support this particular regulation? Well, I don't know. I got to think about that one. He was also grilled on a lot of other stuff that didn't have anything to do with the Cambridge Analytica data breach.
The big news coming out of it, really, from people watching it, that people at Facebook have been involved in the Mueller probe.
Yeah. I mean,
not that should come as any big shock, right, though, if you think about it.
I mean, the thing that surprised me about that, going back to the regulation that you just talked about, was the fact that when pressed about whether or not what the regulations are going to be or are about to be enacted, I think they've already been enacted, but about to go into force in Europe, he was asked whether or not he thought those were good regulations, and he said yes. So, I mean, that's the place to start, I guess, if we're going to talk about regulation, is to look at what are the Europeans asking of Google and other social media companies, and see whether or not that's something that we may need to adopt here in the United States.
You know, I mean, we're all around this table old enough to remember the last time anything like this happened with a technology company, and that's when the Clinton administration went after Microsoft and tried to break them up, ended up in a court settlement, and Microsoft really didn't have to pay that big a price for their monopolistic behavior. But this is another one of those moments, and it's odd that it's coming under an administration that is so anti-regulation. The odds that there might be some crackdown on Facebook and Google and others.
But I think part of it goes back to the fact that not just are we talking about privacy issues, but we're also talking about transparency issues. I mean, you know, people were under the impression that they were in control. And what this shows is that, no, you're not. Your information is out there, and Facebook, in saying that, hey, you know, you have these options, or you can click in or click out, or however you want to describe it, when in fact, it was pretty much open to any of their app developers who could go in and create an app that would basically pull all of that information.
And you talk about transparency. I wish I could remember which one of the senators this was yesterday, because I actually was teaching my online audience development class for the first hour and a half, 2 hours of the testimony. So I kind of said, to heck with this, we're having a watch party. Like, what we were supposed to do that day, we just kind of threw it out. And given that it was a social media class, it felt appropriate. And one of the things was, you talk about that transparency, one of the senators held up the user agreement and what you're agreeing to. And yeah, sure, we know people don't really sign or read the user agreements when they do sign them, I mean. And what he held up looked like 100 pages of paper, you don't realize as you're scrolling, like some of them don't even make you scroll everything that you have agreed to. And to hide behind that user agreement and say, well, we've made it very clear.
Oh, I mean, if you actually sit down and look at that, there is no way it's clear. I mean, it's written in a way to protect the company, not to protect the user.
And I mean, I'll say, even though I was aware of the fact that Facebook was going to be notifying its users whether or not that their data had been breached, if you weren't checking your newsfeed pretty regularly on the day that came down, I didn't find it this morning. I had to find a story online that told me where to go to find that information.
Interestingly enough, I woke up yesterday morning and picked up my phone and I had it. So part of me wonders if I was in an earlier rollout of the announcement from Facebook since my information had been compromised, because everybody I had asked about it who had not yet gotten it later found out that they hadn't been. Really, all you had to do, and I'm sure you found this by going to a very... Kara Swisher was actually talking about this morning Swisher on the Today Show this morning, and then also somebody I know from ProPublica had posted about this, that really all you needed, as opposed to one of these quick hot takes that other publications put out there with search engine optimized headlines, was this one link from Facebook that I've been sharing with anybody who asks, and all you have to do is be logged in, click on the link, and it tells you.
Well, the thing that interests me about this is the theatrics of it. I mean, we've never seen Mark Zuckerberg in a suit, okay?
With a perfect Facebook toned tie.
Yes.
Blue tie.
Yes,
like, watch it in a meme and scroll up and see. It is the Facebook masthead blue tie.
Right. But I mean, it's the classic congressional hearing, you know, all the cameras. The main character walks in and he sits at the table and then he gets
the strategic glass of water from the glass.
And you get but what's happening in the background, which I think NPR and others have done a pretty good job of covering, is that Facebook's army of lobbyists is working behind the scenes to make sure that whatever happens in terms of what we see out in the front doesn't have an impact on them in the back when it comes to any kind of regulation or whatever.
Literally and figuratively, we were actually playing body language bingo, watching the man and the woman sitting behind him yesterday to see exactly how they were reacting. One other thing before we move on that I do want to ask, when you talk about the theatrics that people are starting to talk about a little bit today, was when they did take that 5-minute break yesterday, Zuckerberg left all of his notes on the desk when he got up and walked away, and it became the big photo op. Your take, was that strategic or was that a mistake?
On his part?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't know. But it is one of those things where, going back to a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, when President Trump was holding his notes and they zoomed in on it. So now it's all about, okay, we know what they're saying. What are the notes telling them to say? So now journalists are sort of moving in that direction. I find it fascinating.
My guess is no better than anybody else's, but when the president was being given directions on what to say and not to say, he wasn't taking the directions.
Mark Zuckerberg congratulated Putin.
Mark Zuckerberg being prompted, he was following the script.
Good point.
Okay, so I don't know, what was it? Maybe about a month ago that we first started talking about the Sinclair Broadcast Group's promo. Maybe it was even longer ago. A promo that the anchors in each of its local markets were going to have to read. The script put journalists in the position of criticizing their colleagues and competition at other publications for putting fake news out there and the threat that it might have to our democracy. Mike, you and Ryan Thomas and I characterized that script a few weeks ago as almost being like a hostage script, and that the anchors were being forced to put the statements out there. And we weren't the only ones to see it that way. Yeah, about 2 weeks ago now, Timothy Burke edited a video and he published it on the website Deadspin, compiling dozens of these promos from different markets. And it went viral, starting, in his words, a media war. Before we even get any deeper into this, I want to say that as we discuss this, I am only speaking for myself, not for the Missouri School of Journalism, on behalf of any of our other faculty members or the University of Missouri. But I gotta say, I'm kind of feeling for some of these people in these local markets.
Yeah, and just to be totally transparent, our faculty has been discussing this topic.
We have.
And did today. And there's a question about whether or how people should respond to what they did. And I mean, I think it hasn't changed my opinion at all that what Sinclair is doing at the corporate level is they're being a bad actor. They're doing some things that are jeopardizing free press, that are calling into question trust in media. It's just not the right behavior. The question, though, is whether or not journalists, journalism educators, media critics should be focusing on that as somehow different from all of the other attacks on the institutional trust in journalism today. That's what I worry about.
No, I'm right there with you, Mike. I mean, it's you know, yes, Sinclair is a bad actor, but they've been a bad actor for a long time. I mean, this is just one of many things that Sinclair has done over the years, but they're not the only ones. I mean, you can talk about some of the things that Fox News has done pretty much since its inception. Now MSNBC on the liberal side is doing a lot of the same things. So I mean, it's kind of difficult. I have a difficulty when the media and the media and mass, all the people that you just mentioned, you know, journalism educators, media critics, when they all want to jump on one corporate entity without looking at all the bad actors in all the other corporate entities, and then all of a sudden saying, you know, this one should be shunned as opposed to the others.
I'll give you a classic example. Most evenings when I'm free, I jump back and forth between the cable news shows just to see what they're talking about and how they're talking about them. And it doesn't matter whether it's Fox on the right, MSNBC on the left, CNN, somewhere between those two.
Depending on who's on it.
But the formula is bad for trust in journalism. Mm-hmm. The formula is you take a reporter, either their own reporter or somebody from the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever who's broken a big story, and you plop them down at a table surrounded by political operatives and other people giving their opinions, and a host whose job is to elicit opinions or give their own, and it's blurring the lines between journalism and commentary. Mm-hmm. Or for that matter, we're going to be talking about here in just a little bit about corporations that are hollowing out local news organizations. That's every bit as bad as what Sinclair is doing, and we need to keep our focus on, I would argue, the impact of corporate media on today's journalism and what, if anything, can be done to mitigate against it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, because I think it's gotten more into the area of influence and who you're trying to influence. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it may be the audience, but oftentimes it's someone in the political arena, or maybe someone who is in another corporate arena that may have a connection to the corporate entity that's happened to be running that particular news operation. So, I mean, that's where I think we're going here. And that is lost in terms of transparency, in terms of who are you trying to influence, and who's the audience that you're really trying to reach, and with what message, and what kind of impact does that have on what the public in general needs to know about what's going on in our democratic society.
All that being said, Amy, any time that Sinclair or any other media company does what they did in the past couple of weeks, they should be called out on it. And I certainly think we're going to continue to call them out.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to throw one other part of this as we peel back the onion, too. These promos are out there running. There are then people out there who want to debase the promos. There are now anti-Sinclair promo advertisements running on Sinclair stations. Sinclair has even found a way to be able to capitalize and generate revenue off of this.
Well, I mean, when you think
they kind of are sort of winning at their own game.
Well, I mean, but think about it this way.
Yeah.
I mean, he puts that statement out there.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, I want all of you to do this. Yeah. They do it. Now you've got this tit for tat going. It's, you know, and it plays to his base.
Mm-hmm.
And it works for him. I mean, it's almost like, you know, throwing a lure out there and trying to see if you're going to get a fish to bite on it, and a whole big old school of fish bit on it, and now he's winning. He's winning this.
Okay, so Mike, you texted me on Saturday wanting to talk about a piece that was running on Sunday, wanting to talk about a piece that ran on Politico's website over the weekend, looking at how Donald Trump really continues to thrive in different areas across the country. And each of these areas were characterized by Politico in this piece as being a news desert. What did Politico mean in using that term? Because it's actually been criticized a bit in using it and how it went about reporting the story out.
When they initially came out with the story, what I found interesting about it was that they tried to take data, and in this instance, it was subscription data reported by newspapers around the country. And they took this data and they looked to see whether or not it made a difference how people voted for Trump versus Hillary on whether or not there were a lot of people subscribing to the local newspaper in that community or fewer people subscribing. That's really generalizing it down to its bottom line. And their argument was, from the data, that in places where people were not subscribing to local newspapers as much, there was more support for Trump. And where people were getting more information from their local newspapers, they weren't. Now, as you said, there's been a lot of criticism of that, including, well, does an absence of subscriptions in a local paper mean there's a news desert? Are there not radio and television stations in those markets? Does it mean that if there's a newspaper present in a community but fewer people are subscribing to it in my town versus the town next door, that means there's a news desert? I don't know. But it does say to me that it's really, really interesting if we look at the stakes for community journalism, because where do people learn the habits of finding out information that helps them have a civil discourse, to act on policy, to be informed? More often than not, it starts with the local media, and to the extent that we're hollowing those out, or they're having financial difficulties, or people are for whatever reason not subscribing to local news or watching local news or listening to local news, that's a big problem.
No, I agree with you in terms of the impact that it's having on community newspapers and community news, the local news. It would be good to see what kind of impact does local television have, local radio. But also, what is the impact of our people, as we keep seeing in study after study after study, are people getting more of their news and information online, basically on the cell phones that they carry in their hands? Well, and if they are getting that information, where's that information coming from? Is it a local news operation that they're getting it from? Or are they getting more and more national news, which goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago, seems to be more of that mix of opinion and news disguised as information.
And again, back to that idea and looking at how this story was reported out. Take one of our local newspapers here in town, the Columbia Missourian. You can read that online by answering survey questions mm-hmm. without requiring a subscription.
Right.
So to look at that from subscription, like paid subscriptions, may not necessarily be considered that news desert. Right. If people are still getting it around either graduated paywalls or survey models mm-hmm. instead.
I mean, I do give Politico credit for trying yeah. to do the
analysis.
Oh, no,
I do too. I agree.
Because
yeah.
it seems to me that, you know, we talk about something in research called face validity, right?
Right, right, right.
On the surface, this looks like it could be
yeah.
true.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe on the surface, this could be
yeah.
true.
Okay, so I'm going to be frank. This next one scares me. The Department of Homeland Security is working to create a database to monitor journalists, bloggers, social media influencers, and others. Ask the agency, and they'll tell you the purpose is just to keep an eye on monitoring current events. And it's not that unusual for agencies, for companies to monitor mentions of their business or their agency in the media. They want to know what people are saying about them. It's not that different than an individual setting up a Google alert, but something about the government doing it and it being the Department of Homeland Security feels a little skeezy to me. Like we're being tracked. Or am I just, like the spokesperson for the department says, am I one of those journalists wearing a tinfoil hat?
Well, I mean, you know,
that's how he
well,
described
I mean, but
it.
Think about it. I mean, in today's environment, you know, yeah. people are concerned about privacy. Mm-hmm. People are concerned about their information getting out there. And journalists in particular probably feel that way because they have been under attack to a certain extent by this current administration, and Homeland Security works for this current administration.
And so, roots out terrorists.
And roots out terrorists and does all, you know, does a whole host of things. So, I mean, you know, I can see where you'd be a little skittish about finding out that this is actually going on. I mean, this sort of harpens back to when the FBI was sort of doing these kinds of things pre-Watergate. So, I mean, it's a scary time.
You know, the press secretary for Homeland Security basically did say, anybody who believes this is wearing a tinfoil hat. Black
like
helicopter,
that's
conspiracy
what, that's what he
theorists.
Told the reporter from Bloomberg Law when they started asking and inquiring about this job posting to create this database.
I don't know. I don't go that far. But
okay, good.
And maybe I'm in the minority here, but yeah. I'm not as worried about this as some folks. I mean, first of all, I think it's really a useful database as somebody is collecting information about how Terrorism and homeland security issues are being reported by journalists and bloggers and other influencers around the globe. I wish I had access to a database
But would you? But here's the thing. A government database that's being created, would you? Does it become part of the record?
Probably not. That's exactly what I was about to say. If you're collecting this and it's going to be public and people will be able to pull that information off a database, I'm all for it. But I'm not sure that's going to be the case.
Well, I also
I would hope it is.
There's a good policy reason.
I'm going straight to data.gov to watch for
There's a good policy reason for having this kind of a database. It could be very useful. And if it weren't for, as you say, our sensitivities around this current administration, I'm not sure that people would be as up in arms about it as they are.
You got a point. You got a point.
Okay, so Sunday night, Oprah Winfrey had an especially solid report on 60 Minutes on the history of lynchings across the South and the new memorial in downtown Montgomery, Alabama, that's dedicated to the thousands of lynching victims. This piece used some very graphic photos, ones that might not have ever been published in a newspaper or on television before. And 60 Minutes made the decision that we, the viewing audience, really needed to see those. It was time, and those needed to get out there.
I saw that piece, and you're right. It was pretty graphic. I've seen those many of those photos before, but to actually show them on network television, especially
during the dinner hour,
especially on 60 Minutes, which is still the one of the number one news magazine programs out there, I think was very powerful. And after that, after the piece was over, they actually had
and it's on our links blog,
an explainer that says, "Hey, if you want to know how we made the decision to actually show these, here it is." So I mean, they were very transparent about what it was, but they made the decision. The public needs to see this in order to be able to understand exactly what was going on during that time period and the connection that it has to today. Yeah. Because I think that's the that's one of the missing pieces, and that's the, I would say, the significance of this museum is that it links that time period to what's going on today with mass incarceration and the I guess the difficulty, and difficulty is putting it mildly, the difficult relationship between communities of color and law enforcement.
I mean, I saw the story too, and it seems to me that that's part of our job as journalists to make sure that we don't forget. I mean, just think of the casual horror of that, of lynching a black man or woman. They showed an example, and there's just a bunch of white people sitting around. It's a social event. I mean, we need to know that that was part of our history. I don't know about Oprah fronting the story, because that gets at questions to me again about, you know, journalists versus commentators versus whatever, but it was an excellent story.
Okay, again, if that's something you're interested in taking a closer look at, that explainer as well is on our links blog. We were talking about hollowing out of local news. Well, the Denver Post, it's one of the country's strongest regional newspapers and one with a very storied history. And the staff wants to keep it that way. That's why it's taken a pretty bold move and wrote an editorial asking its hedge fund owners to sell the paper and to put it back in the hands of people who care about the journalism that's being done there.
I read this piece, and I was in shock that no one was fired immediately. I was in shock that they were even allowed to run that piece, basically chastising their owners and saying, "Hey, you need to sell the paper because you don't," literally basically said, "You don't care about this newspaper or the citizens who invest in this newspaper by buying it on a daily basis." I was just stunned when I read that.
Well, in Denver is not a small town. You know, we're really proud of the fact that here in Columbia, it's the smallest city in America with two competing daily newspapers. It's been, what, about 10 years or so since the Rocky Mountain News went under?
Right.
For Denver to not have a strong newspaper where the staff that's working there is proud of the work they're doing all the time. This is a newspaper that won a Pulitzer Prize for breaking news in 2013.
Yeah, with the Aurora shooting.
Yeah.
I agree with you there. I mean, but even when that was going on, the newspaper was heading toward the position it was in now. I mean, the cutting of staff has happened over and over and over again to the point where, you know, you've got pretty much a staff of less than 70, I think.
There's a really telling image that runs with it where they have a photo of the staff, and I wish I can remember off the top of my head what year that photo was taken, but it's not that old,
right,
where they basically erased the people and left the ones who were gone in silhouette and left the ones who were still there. Yeah. And it's 2/3 or 3/4 empty.
Yeah.
And this comes back to my original point about corporate media. You don't have to even look to Denver. You can look right here in Columbia, Missouri to what Gatehouse did to the Tribune. And we've talked about that several times. This is a crisis if community journalism is in this bad a shape. What's going to matter is whether somebody rich in Denver decides to buy that.
Which is what happened in LA. Right?
Mm-hmm. Or whether we find some other way. We've got a fellow who's coming to RJI next year who's going to study whether you can people will tax themselves in their communities and neighborhoods to pay for local journalism. I don't know what the solution is, but just talking about the cuts is not going
to
get us there.
Well, you know, I was talking to someone about this very story this weekend, and what they were saying was basically that when the internet took off, when you first start having Google and newspapers made the decision that they were going to have their content go out there and it was going to be open and free, one of the newspapers that decided not to do that was the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were and now they're one of the ones who are sort of sitting pretty because they're saying our content is what makes us. And if you want our content, you're going to have to pay for it. And now you have news organizations trying to do that. And the only ones who are successfully being able to do that right now, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, to a certain extent, the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they've been able to leverage that out. But the small regional and the regional newspapers, they haven't been able to do that.
Okay, before we go, the WWF. I saw so many people posting photos and talking about the big event in New Orleans this weekend. And it was a total throwback to the time when my dad used to graciously take my younger brother and me to the WWF matches at the Rosemont Horizon in suburban Chicago. We'd watch Hulk Hogan and Randy Macho Man Savage and Andre the Giant, the big guy that most people today remember from the movie The Princess Bride, and who was the subject of a documentary on HBO Monday night. You said you were going to watch it, Mike, did you?
It was on last night. Watch it, and I think it's well worth watching. I mean, it shows, for one thing, the history of professional wrestling going all the way back to a time in America where it was local organizers and local TV stations that were broadcasting
wrestling. Oh, I remember wrestling. Those days. The independent station.
And Andre the Giant was kind of the bridge between that and, you know, the time when you had WWE and you had Hulk Hogan and cable TV made it possible to have national wrestling. But this documentary, even if you don't care about wrestling, is interesting because here was a man who was very much in the public limelight, but he had a lot of problems from growing up with the, you know, this hormonal imbalance that caused him to grow, and he died a tragic death. And in between that, he was a cultural touchstone not only for wrestling, but as you said, probably if you checked with anybody about 20 to 40 years old today, they would tell you about him being on The Princess Bride, and they had some of the actors and the director talking about his influence on pop culture as well. So it's really worth watching.
Okay, well, we'll have to check that out. We are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our link blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to Aaron Hay for making sure that the three of us sounded good today, and to Tim Pilcher, who composed our original theme music. Austin Howard is our associate producer, and I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.